This is the Senate Committee on Judiciary, 27th of February, 1989. We're in hearing room 343 at the State Capitol, having hearings on the following bills. Work session on Senate Bill 299, 275, 276, 516. Public hearing and work session on 632.
Relating to evidence.
This is nice. I think this is what I do things like. Besides the two bills.
Chairman is supposed to be here now.
You want to trade?
Look at your March schedule.
Why don't you go ahead for it? Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Corey Streisinger. I'm Governor Goldschmidt's legal counsel, and I'm here today to offer the governor's support for Senate Bill 275. This bill would expand the circumstances under which a child's out-of-court report of sexual abuse would be admissible in evidence. Under present law, when a child reports that he or she has been abused, the details of that report are ordinarily not admissible. Rule 803.18a of the Oregon Evidence Code allows evidence of the fact that a report was made, but the details of the report, no matter how persuasive and reliable, and no matter whether the child is available for cross-examination, cannot be included unless some other exception to the hearsay rule applies. Senate Bill 275 would allow reports of sex abuse by children under the age of 10 to be used in evidence in limited circumstances. First, the facts surrounding the report would have to include substantial indicia of reliability, as defined in the bill. In determining reliability, the judge could consider such issues as whether the statement contains details that the child would be unlikely to fabricate, whether the statement was spontaneous or made in response to leading questions, and whether the statement is internally consistent. If the child is competent and available as a witness, Senate Bill 275 would require the child to testify in court and be cross-examined. And if the child is not available as a witness, the evidence could be admitted only if it were independently corroborated. Senate Bill 275 represents a carefully crafted attempt to deal with a very troublesome area. It draws a balance between the traditional rules of hearsay and the realities of child sex abuse cases. On behalf of the governor, I urge your support. With me today is Betty Yucatil, Assistant Administrator for the Children's Services Division. I'd like to turn this over to her to describe some of the details of these cases, and then we'll both be available for questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Betty Yucatil. I'm an Assistant Administrator for Children's Services Division. In child sexual abuse cases, there are rarely witnesses. Direct evidence and circumstantial evidence other than hearsay may not be available. At present, it is the young victim's ability to verbalize in the courtroom the details of his or her abuse which will most likely determine the outcome. The child is often under pressure to recant or is simply so young that he or she cannot adequately verbalize the sexual victimization and therefore may not be a competent witness. This is of increasing concern as Oregon had 2,077 victims of sexual abuse under the age of six in 1986-1987. The average age at which male victims disclosed molestation was 7.8 years of age. For female victims, the average age at which they disclosed molestation was 9.7 years. Once the disclosure occurs, these young victims are faced with the harsh realities of present evidentiary procedures. Under certain circumstances, a collaborative statement admitted as evidence would provide the court with needed information to make a more judicious decision regarding the child's need for protection and, in cases of criminal prosecution, conviction of offenders. There would be no criminal convictions based on hearsay alone. Senate Bill 275 offers evidentiary support to child victims of sexual abuse while clearly defining a procedural approach which will ensure fairness to the defendant. We strongly encourage your support for Senate Bill 275.
What questions,
Madam Chair, Corey, what, say if a child is competent and available, child would testify, how is competence defined? Is it defined in the bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, actually competence in hearsay lingo is a species of availability. A witness who is not competent in the sense of not knowing I can't recall the specific details for ordinarily competence of a witness, but not being able to be put under oath and understand the meaning of the oath is not considered to be an available witness. A witness who also has no present recollection is not considered to be an available witness. The bill does not contain independent definitions. It relies on the general rules for availability and unavailability in hearsay cases.
Okay, thank you.
Dale.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would ask permission, Mr. Collins from our association, Yamhill County District Attorney, has worked on this bill for a number of sessions, and he just walked in and he has written comments, and I would defer to him if I may do so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
275, aren't we?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm John Collins, Yamhill County District Attorney and past president of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. This bill, Senate Bill 275, is a bill that we have supported for the last three sessions, and the committee may know some history of it passing the House last session and did not get a hearing, I think, in the Senate this last time. So we are asking for that hearing now and urging the committee to pass the bill out with a due pass recommendation. I have prepared some written testimony, and I believe that's being passed out at this time, and I'll endeavor to summarize it. Under current law, the details of a report of a child victim of sexual abuse is not admissible unless it falls under one of the existing exceptions to the hearsay rule, such as excited utterance or the report to a treating physician. The actual statement made by the child is not admissible under the report of sexual misconduct exception, that's Rule 803, because that exception is limited to the fact of the complaint, not the content of the complaint. It's also not admissible under the general catch-all exception, as the court pointed out in State versus Campbell. Thus, the child's initial report and subsequent reports, what may be the child's most candid statements, are not admitted in court, and the jury is left to speculate regarding what are very logical questions. That is, what did the child say when the matter was initially reported? How did the child act? How consistent was the child in reporting the incident in subsequent conversations with authorities or other individuals in the investigation? Under Senate Bill 275, prior statements of a child under 10 would be admissible in a criminal or juvenile proceeding, provided there are, quote, substantial indicia of reliability surrounding the statement or statements. And the bill provides a list of criteria to determine what is substantial indicia of reliability. The DA's Association urges this committee to find that the bill is needed both from child welfare and from legal considerations. There are increasing number of cases in which a very young child reports to a friend, teacher, or a relative that he or she has been sexually abused. In child abuse cases, their statements are often, those often provide crucial evidence, since physical evidence is usually lacking, and there are seldom other witnesses to the abuse. A child's statement to another outside the courtroom setting also may contain details and spontaneity absent in the child's later testimony about the events. In addition, the child victim may be unavailable to testify at trial. Situations where the child may not be able to testify include cases involving extremely young children who may not be competent to or able to communicate or able to remember what happened to them, or other child victims who would be intimidated by the defendant into not testifying or highly traumatized emotionally by testifying in a courtroom setting. When the child is unavailable, the out-of-court statement may provide the victim's only account of the incident. Even if the perpetrator has confessed to the crime, a conviction cannot be obtained based upon the confession alone. Absent a conviction, the offender is free to continue the abuse of that child or other children. As of checking last week, 33 states have now adopted legislation similar to this. The bill, Senate Bill 275, is based upon Washington law, which in turn is based upon a model presented by the American Bar Association. Any law which admits hearsay statements raises, of course, appropriate concern regarding possible violation of the defendant's right to confront the witnesses against him or her. This bill goes a long way to protect that important right. Decisions of the United States Supreme Court have included or have indicated that the Confrontation Clause poses no obstacle to the admission of out-of-court statements when the person who made the statement testifies at trial. Since the witness is under oath, the defendant has the opportunity to cross-examine the witness about the out-of-court statement, and the jury can assess the demeanor of the witness. In Ohio versus Roberts, a 1980 United States Supreme Court case, the court stated that even if the person who made the statement is not present to testify at trial, the defendant's right of confrontation is not violated, provided there are, quote, adequate indicia of reliability, unquote, to the out-of-court statement. Here, Senate Bill 275 goes even further. One, whether the witness testifies or not, there must be such indicia. Two, the bill provides a list of common sense and case-made criteria defining, quote, indicia of reliability, unquote. Arguably, the bill requires an even greater degree of reliability since the bill requires substantial indicia, not just adequate indicia. Four, the bill requires advance notice to the adverse party by the proponent of the statement, thus allowing the party against whom the statement will be used to prepare to meet the statement. Five, where the child is not available as a witness, the child's statement is not admissible unless there is corroborative evidence of the act of sexual conduct. Such evidence could include a confession, eyewitness account, physical evidence, and access by the accused. Thus, the defendant's rights are protected under the United States Constitution, and the Oregon Supreme Court has indicated an intent to follow the same criteria in interpreting the Oregon Constitution. The constitutionality of the first two state laws adopting this model, Washington and Kansas, have been upheld in the highest courts of both states. This bill, as I indicated, passed the House last time, and we would urge the Senate to push this bill forward this time. Thank you.
Are there questions of John? Senator Grinsky.
I would think that one substantial protection to ensure that the opposition has an opportunity to prepare for this type of hearsay when the witness will be unavailable to testify would be the notice of an intention to offer the statement. And of concern to me is the fact that the statute, or the proposed statute, would only require that the statement, the particulars, be provided sufficiently in advance of the proceeding to provide the adverse party a fair opportunity. I'm wondering if you think that's going to work as a practical matter rather than actually stating a time period.
I think it's going to be something that would be supervised by the judge. So what is an adequate opportunity to respond would be something for the judge to determine on a case-by-case basis. It may be a minor statement that the party has already gotten as a matter of discovery, and thus additional notice may sort of a formality, or it may be something else. If it certainly, I would say that if defense counsel is unaware of a statement, the court would give him ample opportunity to prepare.
There is a statute that requires that beginning his prior sexual misconduct as a defense, and there's a time frame for using that, and it's specific. I think it's 7 days or 10 days prior to the hearing or trial.
I think you're talking about the so-called rape shield law. That does require notice be given a certain period of time prior to.
I'm wondering why not do the same with this. What I can see happening is the prosecution or defense waiting till the day before the hearing, giving the notice over. The judge says, well, we're going to go ahead and let this evidence in anyway. It's a discretionary thing, and I don't think it's that big of a deal. And so what the other attorney gets is a right to an appeal, basically, which isn't worth much in a lot of cases. And I'm just wondering if we can put a time frame on the rape shield defense, which also is something that's flexible depending on what type of a case it is, and yet the committee that put that bill together felt that it was appropriate to have a specific time. I think maybe a specific time might be in order, because I just don't see this working well. There's not the kind of communication, as you know, between a judge, the defense lawyer, and the district attorney about these types of details prior to a hearing. Frequently, they don't even get together until the date of the trial, and it gets lost in the paperwork. It'll be a form notice that'll get sent out, and the judge may not have time to rule on it before it's time for the trial, and it just fouls everything up at that point. Maybe the other side will want a continuance, and he'll have to notify all of his witnesses or whatever.
I guess, speaking for my county, I don't see it as a problem as drafted, but there may very well be problems in other counties, and if the committee thinks that a specific period of time in advance is appropriate, certainly the DA's Association would not object to that.
If I was the attorney with the notice, I would wonder if I'd complied with this statute. Is a day enough? Is a week enough? Is a month enough? How are you going to make that kind of decision? And you can't when the thing just says to provide the adverse party a fair opportunity to prepare to meet the statement. That is so ambiguous. I don't know how the other side would ever know if they had received enough time or if I had given them enough time.
I guess, Senator Grinsky, I compare it to discovery in general, that there's no specific guidelines, so there may be in the court rules, there are no specific guidelines for that, and the question of adequate notice on discovery comes up all the time.
Thanks.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
John, what's been the experience in Washington thus far?
I've heard nothing adverse to the experience in Washington, and I do know that on the constitutional issue, it's been upheld in that state.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Who has to set the table, please?
Madam Chair and committee, I'm Deborah Wilson, and I'm here from the Attorney General's Office, Department of Justice. I'm the attorney in charge of the Family Enforcement Section. Basically, I supervise the attorneys located around the state who do litigation for Children's Services Division and also for Support Enforcement Division. I've submitted testimony here today. It parallels the testimony of the Governor's Office, the Oregon District Attorney's Association, and Children's Services Division, so I won't repeat it here today. However, if you have any further questions, I'd be willing to answer those at this time. And for the record, we do urge the support and passage of this bill.
Okay, let's, we're sort of conferring here because I have to go to another hearing, but in the meantime, we'll call up Robert Reed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and Senators. My name is Robert Reed, and I'm with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association.
Yeah, those things are just immovable, and they're not just...
I won't touch it again.
Right, thanks.
I've done exclusively criminal defense law in Lane County for the past 8 years. I would like to point out briefly some background about this bill. The gentleman that spoke before me referred to Ohio versus Roberts. That United States Supreme Court case basically said that hearsay by a non-witness cannot be allowed in a trial against a citizen charged with a crime unless it's shown both to be the citizen's unavailable and the statement is reliable. This law is designed to do one thing, and it's designed to get more criminal convictions. It is not designed to ensure fair trials or make sure that evidence is reliable. If you look at the definition of unavailability carefully, you will see something that is unknown in Oregon law heretofore, and that is a person is unavailable if they have any lapse of memory at all. I submit to you that in every single case you're going to find a judge being able to agree that the child does not have a complete memory about an incident that happened. It never happens that someone remembers something fully. So in every case they're going to be able to find that the person is unavailable. Also, if you read carefully, the criteria set forth showing what is reliable and what is not, you will see that they are designed again so that only one conclusion can be found. Look, for example, at letter I in the list of factors, whether the child's young age makes it unlikely that the child fabricated a statement that represents a graphic, detailed account beyond the child's knowledge and experience. Again, that is written, as are several of these other factors, in such a way that there can only be one conclusion. This law is unnecessary and it's dangerous. It is unnecessary because already nationwide and statewide, well over 90% of all people charged with crimes end up pleading guilty. Of those people that go to trial on these kind of cases, in the 10,000 some criminal cases I have seen, well over 95% are convicted of this kind of crime. It is dangerous because it essentially allows a person to be tried for a criminal charge without any confrontation of the person that's made that accusation. When children make these statements, they aren't written down and immediately sent to court. They are processed through CSD workers, district attorney's offices, and police associations. Then they get to court. That's going to be the statement that jurors see in this case. I also can say from personal experience, between 25% and 30% of child abuse cases involve a bitter custody dispute or some kind of breakup issue where one parent is encouraging the child to make allegations. I'm not going to make the statement that children always lie because obviously they don't. There's a great problem in this state and every state with child sex abuse, but there is also a problem with parents who are willing to use a child as a pawn in a manipulative game to get back at someone. I've seen a lot of these cases myself. This kind of law will only encourage and exacerbate that manipulation and abusive process. I urge you to carefully take a look at this bill before you decide on how you want to vote on it. Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Hill.
Yes. If you acknowledge that this is a problem,
yes,
then what is your alternative for solving this problem to help us to prosecute this, to deal with the problem?
Well, sir, I read in the Register Guard that between 1975 and 1985, because of education in elementary schools aimed at making young children feel free and aware to make reports on things like this, then the reporting has gone up and the incidence has gone down. I think publicity and education are the answers here.
But what we're, Madam Chair,
please.
What we're talking about, though, is getting, once these cases get to court, which they will.
Yes.
And it really is something that's just really come out of the closet.
Yes.
Recently, I'm saying in terms of a procedure for trying these cases, what do you offer as a better alternative to this? Now, the courts have said that this is constitutional, as I understand.
Well, sometimes, maybe not the way it's written here, but are you suggesting that there is a problem that children should not be allowed to testify in court, or there's some emotional problems caused by that?
I'm saying that a scheme has been put forth here to help us in prosecuting. We realize that this is a big problem.
Okay, yes.
And we're trying to solve it. And I want to know, what alternative do you see? I mean, do you say that we should not do anything to the
no.
law? I'm trying to...
A law that said that statements made by children may be used against the defendant if the child testifies in court and he's impeached. The defense lawyer says, well, isn't it true you said this or that? A law that says that you could bring those prior statements in at that time would be fine, and we have such a law. A law that says statements made for medical or medical diagnosis or something similar like that to a doctor, something under a situation where they're not directly reporting a crime to someone who might have an interest, like a angered stepmother or something, that would be fine. We already have a law like that. The very best thing that you can get, and I'll tell you as a defense lawyer, the most devastating testimony that you can see in court is for the child to get up on the stand and make the accusation known. That's what the right of confrontation is about. There is no reason that that can't work, and in fact, it does work in almost every case. The children get up on the stand and they make the accusation known. There's nothing wrong with that, and that's what happens now. That's why I said there's no need to change the law, because there's a very, very small percentage of these cases that don't result in convictions. Any other questions? I thank you for your attention.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, just one second.
Mr. Reed, you mentioned the on line 14, the language regarding incomplete memory. Did you have a suggestion for an amendment to that of some kind?
Well, I don't see any problem with the current definition of unavailability. If you put complete lack of memory, which I think is the current law, that would be fine, because in most cases, anyone, a child or an adult, isn't going to remember something totally, but complete lack of memory is the status of the law now. If a person just can't remember the basic substance of what they complained earlier, then that would comply with current law. What I'm trying to say, the bottom line here, is the ODAA has been trying to push this bill through to make convictions easier for the past several years. The law is fine as it is, and it works without tampering and eviscerating the constitutional rights of citizens. And when I'm talking about people charged with these kind of crimes, I'm not just talking about some slime ball criminal image we have. I'm talking about teachers, clergymen, coaches, all kinds of people in the community that get accused of these charges, sometimes wrongfully.
Yes, I just want to ask you now, we're not the first ones to act on this type of law.
I understand that.
And we're talking about 33 other states have now, and I mean, you're talking as if we're doing this for the first time and that we're trying to make up a need that isn't there. And that's why I'm trying to, you tell us that there's no need for a change. We have 33 states that have made a similar change.
Well, the 33 states have made a similar change since 1980, and they've basically enacted laws that says if a witness doesn't appear in court, you can use the testimony, hearsay statement, if the witness is unavailable and if it's shown that the statement is reliable. That's what those 33 states have done, and that's fine. That comports with constitutional law at state and federal level. I haven't seen the 33 bills, but I will warrant that they will not get past constitutional muster if they're written like this bill is. This bill basically allows conviction of a person on a serious felony without ever getting to see their accuser, on a situation where someone may not remember 3% of their testimony and where it's almost automatically, by the terms of the bill, decided to be reliable.
I would just say that we don't want to pass anything that's unconstitutional. My sense of it, though, is that there's a good possibility this type of legislation will be passed, and then what I would do is like to get your help in putting a bill together that is constitutional.
Okay. I'd be more than willing to work with counsel on that. So.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next witness would be Mark Blackman.
Good afternoon. Mark Blackman, appearing on behalf of the ACLU. I really want to focus my comments on two issues that I think demonstrate the danger that this bill presents. The first, and the one that is, I think, of greatest concern to me personally, as well as, I think, to the ACLU, is the fact that this bill makes admissible a statement of a witness who is deemed incompetent. Competency under our code of evidence, and it's very difficult to discuss these issues without getting lost in legalese, and I'll try to avoid that. But when the code of evidence was adopted very recently, the definition of competence was also amended to be very, very minimal, so that a witness is now competent if that person has organs of sense and can perceive, and once perceiving, can make known the perception to others. That is all it takes to be deemed competent in our state, the ability to perceive and the ability to present that perception to others. I submit to you that a witness who does not have that minimal capacity either to perceive or communicate should not be deemed such that their prior statements are admissible in a court of law. By definition, it should be just the opposite. If the person lacks the capacity to perceive in the first place or to accurately report, then our rules of procedure, protection of the process of finding the truth, would indicate to me anyway, and it seems so logical, it's hard for me to say it any other way, that that's exactly the person who should be subjected to the tests of truthfulness that come with a judicial proceeding, not the opposite. And I submit to you that the real danger in this bill is it takes the least reliable witnesses, those who don't qualify as competent under this very minimal standard, and insulates them entirely from any process to determine whether there's any truthfulness or lack of truthfulness to their statement. It is, I would urge you to recognize a very dangerous thing indeed to present this type of evidence, especially in the highly emotionally charged kinds of cases that are normally going to be involved here. Competence is a minimal requirement, and this statute only exacerbates an existing problem. The other point I would make is that unlike any other state, Oregon has a constitutional provision which specifically precludes the admissibility of hearsay statements except, and I'll quote from the Oregon Supreme Court case that established the principle, except as to those well-established, as a quote from State Ex Rel Lonergan v. Gladden, except for those statements which are well-established exceptions to the hearsay rule. And basically what the court has said in the past is that a hearsay exception that was in existence at the time of the adoption of the Oregon Constitution is immune from attack under our Confrontation Clause, but that unless it was well established at that time, it violates Article 1, Section 11 of the Oregon Constitution. No other state has that provision in its Constitution. Oregon is one of very few states that specifically has interpreted its constitutional provision regarding the right to meet witnesses face-to-face, and that's the language our Constitution uses, different from the federal Constitution, to be more rigorous in its protection of the process. And so for those two principles,